Welcome to the Berean class. We're doing a series on Christian ethics, and we are and have been for the last 2 weeks talking about family values and specifically homosexuality. As you very well know, this is a topic that most people avoid, and I probably should avoid because I tend to be not nearly as careful in terms of talking about this subject as probably I need to be and survive. The lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, TJBT, if you aren't familiar with that term, you should be. And you may not be personally interested in this subject, but your culture is. And almost every aspect of the political end of our culture is affected by the issue of sexual and gender orientation. Specifically, as it is in conflict, quote-unquote, with the Christian faith in the minds of many people. Many evangelical Christians are caught between two spiritual virtues. On the one hand, they're sensitive, we are sensitive to the pain and the difficulty that professing Christians have with respect to sexual orientation problems or issues. We have gay friends, and they don't fit the profile of a lot of the traditional descriptions that come out of some Christian traditions. We're perplexed by that. And I think that if we basically follow our hearts in terms of our inclinations toward this issue, the danger is we're accused of being homophobic. That is, if we don't follow our hearts. On the other hand, as Christians who take seriously the teaching of Scripture, we read scriptures that really address this issue in a negative way. And as a result of that, we feel compelled to respect that truth. And if we don't do that, we basically are Christian heretics. So we have this truth and love tension. It's not just on this issue, but in this issue especially, it comes to the fore. Four critical questions outline basically how I'm addressing this. Last week, we looked at the first two issues. Is homosexuality about action or attraction? And I mentioned that distinction is very important. Until the modern era, homosexuality was a behavior. But beginning at the turn of the century, with a modern technological age and a modern perspective on human nature, there was this development of a notion of an orientation or an identity. For example, before the turn of the century, it would have been inappropriate to talk about someone as a homosexual. A person could do homosexual acts, but to be a homosexual is something that was unheard of. For example, in Jesus' day, or in Paul's day, actions were viewed. You can have sex with the same gender. That was can be described as a homosexual act. But having a homosexual orientation was something that was foreign. So when we read the New Testament, we've got to keep that in mind. And yet, oftentimes when the discussion takes place today, it has to do with orientation, not action. The second question, is homosexuality a curse depicting the fall of humanity, or is it just about a small group within the same-sex attraction community? In other words, is the curse described in Romans chapter 1, where God basically turns people over to the direction of their heart and corrupts their sexual orientation, as we read Romans chapter 1? Is that something that's a peculiar problem to people who have a same-sex attraction? Are they particularly sinful and rebellious? Or is what Paul describing there a description of what is taking place with all of humanity. And some people in the culture of the human race bear a burden of a distorted sexual orientation. In the same way, for example, when the curse was placed upon the people of Egypt during the Exodus, the firstborn son of a family was taken as a part of the curse to let the children of Israel go. Now, if you were in a family that didn't have a firstborn son, you escaped the real pain. If you had a firstborn son, you bore the pain. Now, does that mean only those with firstborn sons were under the curse? No, the whole Egyptian country was under a curse. But some people bore that curse symbolically in terms of the sacrifice they made. And we might say the same thing with respect to a same-sex orientation. In other words, the point I'm making is this. People who have a gender orientation that leads them to be attracted to the same sex are not necessarily in greater rebellion toward God than someone who isn't. Now, the behavior, however, becomes a different issue, because that's what the New Testament addresses. Yes?
Could the Old Testament and New Testament distinction of a eunuch cover someone with a same-sex attraction?
Could
the Old Testament and New Testament, just their blanket description of a eunuch, cover a person who has same-sex?
Cover a person? No,
well,
what do you
mean? Include, address, a eunuch.
Repeat the question, Jim.
Yeah. When the Old Testament and the New Testament talks about a eunuch, how is that related to sexual orientation?
Right, because the Bible, or Jesus even says there are some that are born eunuchs, and
right,
some that are made eunuchs, and I don't know, there's like
right,
different
eunuchs. Right.
So could that be somebody who was born not wanting to...
No, a eunuch was not someone with an orientation. A eunuch is a term that describes not an orientation, but a physical phenomena of castration, usually.
When you translate the word, I mean, the word from Greek, it means a safe bed. In other words, somebody's wife is safe.
Right.
But I just wondered if that could be a blanket.
Not that I'm aware of. But that was last week. This week, two more questions. When should private morality drive public, that is, social and legal policy, and how do we balance individual freedom and general welfare? We'll talk about that. And then secondly, is the homosexual issue reflecting a bigger and deeper theological issue, and I'm going to argue that it does. But let me just tell you basically where I'm going to go with this. Respect to question three, what I'm going to argue is that the general welfare is the area, the arena, at which Christians and non-Christians should debate this in a pluralistic society like America. We can have theological understanding and opinions, but they are not going to be weighty in terms of a pluralistic society where many people do not share our theology. The Constitution indicates that the government of the United States of America has a responsibility to respect the general welfare. And I think arguments for the general welfare are appropriate in the public square in terms of issues like this. And we'll talk about that as we go on. And then the second question, is homosexual issue reflecting a bigger and deeper theological issue? And I would say, in my judgment, yes. And the issue is this. It's not about homosexuality. It's about sexuality, period, as a messiah in terms of a doorway to our identity and our life. And this is, I'm going to argue, why a lot of people who are not just gay, but people who are gay, are fighting for their soul. Because to take away the avenue of the expression of their sexuality is to rob them of the doorway they have to feeling alive and feeling as though they are have an identity as a human being. And now the same is true with heterosexual people. And I'm going to argue in a couple of weeks, most of us, many of us, have that same kind of attachment to our work, giving it a messianic role, or to our families. As a matter of fact, there are a whole lot of false messiahs out there that we cling to because we think it'll bring us life or make us feel alive. But sexuality is a particularly strong impulse that is tied closely to the core of our being, and therefore becomes a very easy candidate for what I call sexual idolatry. The late Richard John Neuhaus, I think, concisely puts it. In the gay community, it would seem the maxim is love the sin and love the sinner, but hate anyone who calls it a sin or him a sinner. By the way, Richard Neuhaus, an author that I greatly admire, was a Lutheran who converted to Catholicism, and not in the process, but before and after that, became a very, very strong and powerful advocate for intellectual issues in the name of the Christian faith. He grew up a strong socialist, activist, and later in life became a neoconservative, economically and socially. He was one of a number of people who made that switch. This is an expression that I didn't write, but it expresses to a large extent how I would describe my position. Yes, I am a Christian. I believe the Bible. I do not support homosexual acts or homosexual marriage. Yes, I still love you. Yes, we are still friends. No, I am not condemning you to hell. No, I will not let anyone bully you. But realize that name-calling and stereotyping those of us who stand for what we believe is exactly what you don't want done to you. We have a right to speak what we believe, same as you have a right to speak what you believe. And that, I think, concisely describes basically where I put myself. Ordinarily at that point, I would shut up and leave. But I'm not going to do that. We'll look at the third question. When should private morality drive public social legal policy? How do we balance individual freedom and general welfare? Are there any good reasons other than religious doctrine that homosexual behavior should be resisted or at least discouraged in public life? Is there an argument that's critical of homosexual acts that is legitimate in a pluralistic society? That's the question. Let's look at some examples. A bakery run by a conservative Christian is asked to make a cake for a gay wedding. This is, of course, a real case. It's been in the press in the last several weeks. What is the government's responsibility in a situation like this? Is a private business that makes money off of a public sector obligated to respect or refrain from exercising its religious convictions with regard to who it serves?
Wouldn't the Christian thing be to make the cake? That's the Christian thing to do?
Well, that's the debate.
Right, but I'm just saying that's the other side of
it. Yeah, yeah. Well, for those who basically who find this an example of homophobia, I think we could look at some other examples that would be hypothetical but real in terms of possibility. Exodus, which is an organization that basically is committed to delivering people from a homosexual orientation to a straight orientation.
A year ago closed down. They said they no longer support reparative therapy.
And yeah, I know they've been very controversial.
Yeah, but they actually don't exist anymore.
Okay. Let's just go back and assume that there are many organizations like Exodus that do the same thing. There are churches that do the same thing. If Exodus or an organization like this asks a gay community center to host a promotional event, including testimonials, should that community center be obligated to rent their property for that purpose? Or Jews for Jesus asks a Jewish bakery to cater an evangelistic rally in the community. If we want to attract Jewish people, get a Jewish bakery to make the bagels. Does the Jewish bakery at a situation like that say, no thank you, make your own bagels? We cannot do this.
I don't know what Jews for Jesus is.
Jews for Jesus is a evangelical Christian organization that basically ministers the gospel to Jewish people. And they're Jewish people who have been converted to the Christian faith for Christ is seen as their Messiah. But they hold on to Jewish tradition, but embrace Jesus as their Messiah.
So what's the common denominator of all three of these questions?
All three of these questions raise the issue. Where do you draw the line? What does the government, what authority does the government have to force people to restrain from exercising their personal religious convictions in light of and in respect for people who differ from them?
Are you talking about all governments or American governments?
All governments, but American governments specifically.
A little bit different.
Right, right. If you're in an Islamic country, that's not a problem. biblically speaking, these are some texts that come to bear. Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Matthew chapter 22, verse 21. This makes some people nervous. If rendering to Caesar seems like a compromise with the world, that was the position the Pharisees took. The reason they did not like Jesus, did not respect him, is because he fellowshiped with sinners. He was too close to people who were not holy. On the other hand, rendering to God, for many Christians today, and specifically as seeing that as distinct from Caesar in some way, may seem like a cop-out. The Puritans basically saw God as Lord of everything, including secular government. So basically, to make a distinction between serving God and serving Caesar, that's giving Caesar way too much authority. Caesar must submit to God. And many people would look at that distinction as a cop-out. The challenge is to be in the world but not of the world. But that is not easy. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 to 10. We looked at this passage a few weeks ago. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral people, Paul says. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or swindlers, or with idolaters. For then you would have to go out of the world. In other words, he was saying to the Christian community, I don't want you to withdraw from interaction, from relating to people of the world who don't share your moral convictions. Now the question is, how much association are we to have with those who do not share our moral convictions? And what kind of association are we to have in those relationships? Some people would say, very little. And others would say, a whole lot. That's part of the tension. That's part of the debate. Reason certain moral behaviors should be permitted and yet discouraged in a pluralistic society. Navigating that water in terms of in but not of the world means that there are certain things that we will permit, but for reasons discourage. Yes?
Did you mean immoral behavior? Is a certain immoral behavior?
Yes, yes. I should say certain behaviors. I mean by moral or immoral, in the category of morality. certain behaviors with respect to morality should be permitted and yet discouraged. The criteria we use here, oftentimes, if you're of a religious persuasion in certain circles, religious teaching and tradition basically governs what you feel should be take place in broader society. This is why, for example, you'll see even politicians sometimes quoting the Bible with respect to moral behavior and legislation in America. That creates a problem if you don't respect the authority of Scripture. The other extreme is political correctness. Whatever is popular in culture, whatever basically people want, is to set the agenda. The Constitution says that it's the promotion of the general welfare that really is at stake. Government's responsibility is to, among other things, promote the general welfare, whatever that means. That is, what is good for most people, what is good for people generally in society. That's left unspecified, but that is the doorway, and that's where the appeal and debate should be made. Two examples. Smoking. Smoking is not a capital crime. You're permitted to smoke, but you're discouraged from doing so, in certain places especially. Promiscuity. You can be promiscuous sexually without being arrested in America, but you're discouraged from behaving that way. These are behaviors that are discouraged but permitted. There are many other examples we could use. Now the question is, what about homosexual behavior? Does it fall into that category? Should it? Is homosexual behavior a general welfare issue? And I think the argument that some people would make is that it is. And as Christians, reflecting a biblical view, you come to the public square not with a Bible verse and on a placard, but you come with an appeal to the general welfare.
Yes. My apologies for interrupting. But your two examples are interesting, because promiscuity, I think there's a clear relationship to that and homosexuality.
Right.
And but I'm trying to think, clearly for smoking, we as a political body, we do discourage that politically. We have laws restricting where we can. We tax it.
Right.
But promiscuity, I don't know that there's actually... I mean, there still are laws in the books.
Right, that aren't enforced.
But there aren't street signs that says, you know, be careful, don't go to bed with anybody you see.
Right.
Where there are street signs that say, you know, no smoking here.
Right.
So it's gone beyond even... You know, the laws are still on the books, although a lot of those have been eliminated, I think, in the
right
state.
Right.
So I think there's a relationship there that's important. The lack of enforcement of promiscuity laws and even updating them and making them relevant is related, I think, to the homosexual level. And we don't tax it either. I mean, we don't tax promiscuity.
Right.
That I know of. There may be some... Well, I mean, I say that in jest somewhat, but...
Yeah.
They do in some countries. They have their red light district. And they pay taxes.
That's true. But I don't know if that.
Well, as a matter of fact, when I've had a chance to talk about this subject on the UNC campus, they haven't asked me to do that lately. But in the past, when I've had that opportunity, well, they've asked me to talk about homosexuality. I generally say two things. I say, one, I'm in favor of gay rights. Like every other citizen has rights, so do gay people. Along with liars, and along with people who are greedy, and along with people who have all kinds of other anomalies and moral differences with people around them. On the other hand, I resist the idea that people with who are gay activists have a right to special attention as though they were a class of discriminated people in the same way that African Americans have been, or in the same way that in many cases women have been, so forth and so on. Affirmative action steps are not needed here. And furthermore, this is a public or a general welfare issue. We've got to ask ourselves hard questions about whether or not this is really good for the population generally. Cal Thomas, who's a Christian and a reporter, had this to say, and I think it's relevant. AIDS is the only disease in history which has been treated politically and not medically, merely because of its incredible lobbying efforts. These lobbyists try to obscure the fact that most of those with AIDS are professing and practicing bisexual, homosexual, and drug users who will not take responsibility for their own actions. Behavior accounts for over 90% of those with AIDS, yet it is treated like a plague which just dropped out of the sky and affects poor, innocent people who have no responsibility for its acquisition. AIDS receives more funding, $9.9 billion annually, than cancer research, $5.1 billion. While a host of other diseases, many of which have been around for a long time, are not behavior related, are left with very little funding to find cures. I think that's a very good point. Is homosexuality natural? That is, orientation natural? In Romans chapter 1, we have a strong teaching in Paul's language that challenges its natural status, exchanging the natural function for that which is unnatural, are the words that he uses. The same language is used in non-Christian authors in antiquity, denouncing homosexual acts. Plato, Philo, Josephus, Plutarch, the Greek historian, all labeled homosexual acts as being unnatural. But then the question is natural defined by what feels normal to me or by what is healthy given my created purpose? In other words, my gay friends would say, to me, my orientation is natural to me. You are heterosexual, that is natural to you. Now, why is my homosexuality, my orientation, natural to me? Because that's what it feels natural to me. But then the question comes, there are many things that can feel or seem natural, like pedophilia, promiscuity, honor killing, hatred, revenge, racism, sexism. Does that mean it's natural? I may basically have a problem with anger. Does that mean that it's natural simply because it feels normal for me? Or I think the explosive example is pedophilia. There are many people who have an attraction sexually for children. And that seems perfectly natural to them. Does that mean that it is indeed natural? And should it be respected? Well, I say, well, no, but not on the basis of that. It's not because it hurts children. As though, in some way, adult homosexual behavior does not hurt anybody. Now, that's where the argument goes. In 1974, 55% of the members of the American Psychiatric Association voted to remove homosexuality from the category of conditions which are in themselves pathological or diseased. That means 45% at that point did not recognize that. This change took place because of four things. Intense gay activist protests against the APA's convention, American Psychological Association's convention, in San Francisco in 1970-1971. Without that, this change probably would not have taken place. The quote-unquote scientific work of Alfred Kinsey, which is now questioned in many respects, the desire to address social injustice to the gay population, and a change in the definition of what normal sexual adaptation consisted of. The point is, the change in the way in which the mental health professionals viewed homosexuality was conditioned on a number of things that weren't entirely scientific. In 1977, just a few years after this change has been made, 10,000 psychiatrists noted, however, that 69% of them said yes to the question, is homosexuality usually a pathological adaptation? 18% said no, 13 uncertain. But the point is, this is still something that's up in the air, although political correctness has made it very difficult for anyone to criticize homosexuality. Dr. Stanton Jones, provost at Wheaton College, made a statement that got him in hot water. This was it. I would not regard homosexuality to be a psychopathology in the same sense of schizophrenia or phobic disorders, but neither can it be viewed as a normal lifestyle variation on par with being introverted versus extroverted. That statement was seen as explosively inappropriate by the gay community. And, well, it gets worse. Mark Regeneris is a psychologist at the University of Texas, Austin. He got his PhD here at Carolina. He is a Christian. He does research primarily in religious studies and in sexuality. This is his field. His research came to three conclusions when he basically studied the behavior of children who grew up in homes where their parents were, or the parents who raised them were two lesbians or two male homosexuals, primarily two lesbians. What happens in the lives of these children? There's reason, he concluded this, there's reason for concern that the welfare of children reared by same-sex households may be compromised. With an emphasis on maybe, we can't know for sure, but the clouds don't look good, the statistics don't look good. Gender matters in parenting, and but by that he's me saying it's important for in every home there to be a father and a mother, not just two mothers, not just two fathers. Children need both. That makes a difference, he's saying. And more study is needed before we rush to political conclusions. In other words, there's clouds on the horizon here. Don't rush to conclusions. We need more study. This got him in all kinds of trouble.
When was that study done? Do you know?
2 years ago.
Okay.
His research was peer-reviewed, published in a leading sociological journal, Social Science Research, but has been attacked and rejected by the APA and others. And people have asked for his resignation. The University of Texas in Austin put pressure on him to renounce his research, so forth and so on. Lots of bad things happening professionally for him. Yes, Dorothy.
Many studies of this nature were done outside of the sexual context as well. For instance, studies that were done in Norway after the Second World War of children that
right.
were raised within the fishing villages, and they come to the same conclusion. It's totally sexual orientation. Didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, I'm not a sociologist, and I have to qualify what I'm saying here with respect to, I'm looking at this as a layperson from a distance. I have sociologists who are friends. I talk to them about this all the time. I search the internet looking for articles and for papers that can give me some idea what's going on. I am totally confused with respect to where the things are. And when I ask my sociologist friends, so are they. People are on one side or the other, and both using the same research. Here is something of what he discovered in his research. 35% are more likely to fail a grade in school. 70% needed social services at some point in their life. 50% needed public welfare assistance, compared to 17% or 10% of the general population. 27% experienced sexual violence, either to them or were perpetrators of that. And 40% had long periods of unemployment compared to 6% of the general population. And nearly all of them reported a negative view of their childhood. Yes?
How does this compare to like children who are brought up in single-parent households? Because effectively that's the same thing. thing. There's a single gender. There's not both gender patterns.
That I don't know. That data is probably in his study someplace, yes.
That data does exist. I remember reading that it depended on why why they were single parents. If it was the case of a death, there was almost no difference. If it was the case of divorce, there was a huge difference.
Yeah. That would make sense. But the point is, his study basically made these observations. His conclusions were, be cautious. Don't rush to conclude that it makes no difference who raises the children, whether it's two lesbians or a biological father and mother. And he's saying that because that's the conclusion that is being reached in the politically correct gay community. How stable are gay relationships? Now, again, most of this stuff if it's at all negative, is contested vehemently. But as far as I can tell, and looking at lots of data, this is pretty much the way it falls out. Most gay relationships last 6 months or less. 12% will end in a year. 35% will last as long as 5 years. And 16% will last for more than 5 years. Another way of looking at it is this way. When you compare homosexual and heterosexual relationships, after 4 to 7 years, 80% of heterosexual relationships are still intact. 29% of homosexual relationships are still intact. After 16 years, it's 50-4. The point is, gay relationships have a lot of stability problems for a number of reasons.
So how are you defining relationships here?
Married relationship. Where basically people are identified with one another. Certainly, as we're going to see, male homosexuals have lots of relationships with other males. But in terms of living together as a partner, yes.
That last study was done in 2003.
Right.
So my question is, now that it's more socially acceptable, do you think those numbers are different today?
I don't think so. From what I've been able to surmise, they are. And for a number of reasons.
Why aren't there more recent statistics?
There may be, but I don't have access to them.
And it's politically incorrect, too.
Well, it's hard to get stuff published that is negative on this subject. The pressure academically is so strong that if you're not politically correct, or if they sense that you may not be politically correct in your conclusions, it's hard to get funding for the research. And then to get a journal to publish the material if it's not correct. This is a very, very difficult issue to deal with. Whenever someone throws up statistics, you've got to qualify them and say, this is hotly contested stuff.
Excuse me.
Yes.
On the last part you just
covered,
I don't understand why straight is 22 and straight is 7 there. So the comparison.
It's basically lesbians versus male. Male and female. Gay is a term used for male homosexuals, lesbian for female.
I understand that, but I don't understand why the number for straight wouldn't be the same on both sides.
Male and females. Straight male, straight female, and stuff for domestic violence.
So this is how many women are receiving domestic violence
right.
left, and how many men are receiving?
In short, what it means here is this. Lesbian relationships are hostile. If you want to fight, get in a lesbian relationship. Now, here's the answer that's given why that is. This is not contested, by the way. These statistics come from the gay community. They say the reason is because women, by nature, demand so much of a relationship that when you get two of them together, both two ticks looking for a dog, there's going to be a problem. Now, I don't mean that. Well, I use that. diversity of relationships. I use that expression, and those of you who've heard me teach this before. In a marriage, oftentimes we have two ticks looking for a dog. We have basically people who are trying to find life and suck the blood out of anything that will give them life, a husband or a wife. So it's not to suggest that lesbians are dogs or ticks, either one.
They'll never listen to
it. Yeah, this I should have quit a long time ago. The life expectancy of a gay male in America is shortened by 20 years. That has not changed, even though this research is again, probably 15 years old. Depression is 7 times more likely among male homosexuals, and suicide is 6 times more likely as compared to the control group. 75% of the general population believe homosexuality is wrong, but that homosexuals should have equal rights in the workplace, and I would agree with that. 75% of gay men have had sex with more than 100 partners. 43% with more than 500, and 28% with more than 1,000. That sounds absolutely incredible until you begin to look into the culture of gay relationships. 79% say that half of those partners are total strangers, and 70% of those sexual contacts are one-night stands. 73%, this is really shocking, of gay men have had sex with boys under 18 or under 19 years of age. Monogamy in gay marriage is rare. A distinction between emotional fidelity and sexual exclusivity is commonly made. And what I mean by that is this. In a homosexual marriage, if understood, we are a partner emotionally. We're faithful to one another. But it's agreed we're going to have sex with lots of different men. Both of us. That's, yes.
With the two studies that you've got, 78 and 79, I'm kind of curious, in your research, are those numbers still relatively accepted by...
Well, these numbers are ignored pretty much by the gay community, right. But the question is...
Nobody's contesting them.
Oh, yes, they're all contested. And the only thing that I would say is this. You can change these numbers. The point is the trend there is unmistakable. And I have a quote here from a leading representative of the gay community in just a moment that explains something of why that is. How monogamous are gay relationships? These statistics are not contested. They're explained, but not contested. Married females who are straight, 85%. Married males, 75%. Homosexual males in current relationships, 4.5%. And again, indicating the same level of promiscuity. Here's the quote by Andrew Sullivan. There's more likely a greater understanding of the need for extramarital outlets between two men than between a man and a woman. In other words, men tend to be more promiscuous, he argues, so when you get two men together, obviously there's going to be more promiscuity. That is part of the rationale. These statistics in terms of promiscuity are not contested. When I've had a chance to speak publicly in a hostile environment, the first thing I say is, as I said before, I'm for gay rights. The second thing I say basically has to do with this issue. I'm against promiscuity. In other words, if I can get the audience to agree that promiscuity is not a good thing for society, I basically address the homosexual issue. Because to argue against promiscuity is pretty much to shut down a lot of the gay culture. Because it is almost synonymous with promiscuity. In the context of studying HIV risk behavior among young homosexual men in the Netherlands, the first country in the world to legalize homosexual civil marriage, the researchers found that, one, homosexual men who were in partnered relationships for an average of eight, had an average of eight sexual partners per year outside the primary relationship. Those without a permanent partner had an average of 22 sexual partners per year. So marriage in the gay community did cut down on the promiscuity from 22 to 8 different partners a year. That's good news. At least that's the way it's advertised. So much for the statistics. The point I'm making here is this. When the issue of homosexual behavior as a entitled and protected behavior in society is on the dock, Christians and non-Christians alike can argue that this is not in the interest of the general welfare. Again, it's an argument that's going to be shouted down, but I think it's an argument that's legitimate. There are reasons to believe this is not good for society. Is homosexual issue reflecting a deeper issue? Is the homosexual issue reflecting a deeper issue? Will gay marriage be enough, for example? There's a lot of clamoring now for recognizing gay marriage. I would argue this. Most gay men are not that interested in being married. In places where the laws have been changed, statistics indicate that 20% of gay couples choose to be married. 80% would prefer not to be married. I would also argue that, and this is just my theory, my observation, that the real issue here is not marriage and not the benefits that come with marriage legally. The real issue is respectability. The real issue is to recognize that until my relationship with my significant other, male partner, is put on par with every other relationship, I am a second-class citizen in the culture. And I want to make my relationship work to bring about happiness. And right now, we're not happy like we should be, primarily because y'all don't accept us as one of y'all. The kind of thing. And if we could just be accepted, that'll help us be happy. I'm getting a little facetious here. I think that's a big part of it. That's why I say, once gay marriage is recognized, and it will be recognized in our culture, in my lifetime, and in just a few years, it'll be a national thing. That's not going to change a great deal. It'll be on to another issue to basically up the ante in terms of the respectability and the credibility of homosexual behavior. Is the real issue sexual idolatry? I would argue it is. And that is a problem that affects not just gay people. It's a problem that affects a lot of other people as well. There are a lot of people who look at their gender relationships, be they male or female, as a primary source of their well-being, the well-being of their soul. And there are a number of people who have made work their idol. And they identify themselves with their work in such a way that that becomes a real issue. And I would argue that workaholics and people who have gay relationships are not in terribly different categories. When we basically find our life in something other than Christ, when our soul's basic nourishment, when the source of our well-being is something other than the image of God within us and our relationship with Christ, we have a problem. It's an idolatry problem. It's an addictive problem. It's just a matter of what we're addicted to. And I really believe that that is one of the great challenges in terms of spiritual warfare that we face, is who is the Messiah? Who is the functional Messiah in our life? What gives us a sense of being alive? And sexuality is a big part of that. The reason I say that is with passages like this, Galatians chapter 5. Now the deeds of the flesh, Paul says, are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, And things like these, we could go on and on and on and add that list. I make this note. Where do we look for life apart from God? And you can divide this long list, I'm suggesting, into three categories. Sexual fulfillment, immorality, impurity, sensuality. Spiritual enlightenment, idolatry and sorcery. Or social status, our relationship with others, and specifically our competitive advantage with others. Enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envyings, drunkenness, carousing. All of these terms fit together and have one thing in common. They have to do with how we see ourselves in relationship to others. And the scripture is not giving us this outline. I'm just drawing this outline by looking at these terms and saying, what do they have in common? And it seems to me that our flesh wants to find life in anything and everything but God. In the three big categories, based upon my 40 years of observing people and looking into my own soul, are sexual fulfillment, spiritual enlightenment, social status. Those are big categories for idolatry. Big categories for false messiahs. And one is not worse than the other. Some are more acceptable in our culture than others. It just so happens that sexual addictions are really on the bad list among Christians. Christians really have no problem with spiritual enlightenment and social status. As a matter of fact, we celebrate, as someone said, when a person's drunk on wine, they kick him out of the church. When he's drunk on money, they make him a deacon. But there's no problem with that. Many people who are passionate about sexual freedom are fighting for their hope of life, human fulfillment and wholeness. And this is why this is such a hot issue. This is more than just an intellectual debate. This is a situation where people are fighting for their souls. And you can tell a lot about where your idols are by how strong you fight for them and how resistant you are to giving them up, or letting them go, or having them taken away. When you lose something, you find out how important it is to you. We live in a generation that has cast its lot in the quest for life with sexual fulfillment, spiritual enlightenment, social status, I would argue. But it has confused the creation with the Creator. And in seeking life apart from God, it has lost it. When we seek our life, ourselves, we tend to lose it. What should Christians do? This is a summary. Support the legal rights of all Americans, including gays and lesbians. Encourage open, respectful debate on public policy with respect to competing values. Affirm the necessity of and the unavoidable tension between competing moral values in our system. Recognize it's not going to be a Christian society. Never was intended to be a Christian society in terms of all of its moral details. Learn to live with people who differ with you, just as the first century church did in the Roman Empire. Work together to create compromises with respect to pleasing as much as possible all sides of contested issues. And let the general welfare be a driving rationale for public policy. And then thirdly, engage the gay community with humility, sensitivity, reason, and love. And unfortunately, my observation is the church has either caved in to the gay community, or it has basically shouted it down with insensitivity, a lack of love, a lack of humility, and a lack of learning from that community, and seeing itself and its own soul in that community. In John chapter 8, and we have the story of Jesus confronting the woman caught in adultery. The Pharisees bring her before Jesus. The law demands that she be stoned to death. And they basically test Jesus with her case and say, what should we do? And he basically says to them, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. Now, they were absolutely convinced that that was enough to get Jesus lynched. The stones were going to be going at him. But here is what was taking place. The Pharisees saw in this woman a sinner. They barely saw the image of God. What Jesus saw was the image of God marred by her sin. Now, the question and challenge for us, do we look at the world and those who disagree with us the same way Jesus did? And I fear that for many of us, we look at other people in terms of how they have basically sinned, not in terms of bearing the image of God. And the worse the sin in the culture, the harder it is for us to see the image of God in them. And I would suggest that, especially with respect to the gay community, if you're not gay, and most people here are not gay, if you're addressing friends or that issue, in that community, see the image of God and people fighting for their soul. We have a message of hope for the soul. The first question we should ask is, are we cashing in on that message? Is that really our hope? Or are we just have a different addiction or a different idol than our gay friends or lesbian friends? But to treat them with the same love and respect that their image of God warrants.
It did say, go and sin no more.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But he said that after.
Yes.
He said, neither do I condemn you. Now, I think the order there is important. Next week, the ethics of work. So we'll go from one idol to another next week.
All right.